Hello and welcome to Golden Grenades, a podcast about birds with stories from those of us who worship them, all set against the heartwarming and uplifting backdrop of the end of the world. Today, my very special guest is Dawn Barmer. Dawn has been a bird watcher from a very young age and started her first bird notebook at the age of six. She started work at the British Trust for Ornithology in 1992, initially on a 16-month contract, working on the Common Birds Census. And since then, her role has encompassed fieldwork, organising ringing projects and bird track, and working as coordinator for the Bird Atlas 2007 to 2011. Now, as head of surveys, she oversees a host of long-term schemes and projects. Alongside her work for the BTO, she became the first female member of the British Ornithologists Union Rarities Committee and more recently, the British Birds Rarities Committee. She is the chair of the Rare Breeding Birds Panel, secretary of the European Bird Census Council, and is a volunteer director and editorial panel member of British Birds. She is a passionate advocate for local survey work and has somehow found time to perform a vast number of surveys near her home for over 30 years. Dawn, hello and welcome to Golden Grenades.
Hi, Kit. Great to speak to you today.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm surprised you've got time with all the different jobs that you do. You must be an extremely busy woman. And you've dedicated your working life and, from the sounds of it, a decent percentage of your free time to birds. I'm sure we'll talk a bit about how you got into that a bit later on, but I wanted to ask a little bit about your first volunteering job.
Yeah, sure. No, I was really lucky. I did my work experience at school. So I was, you know, whatever, sort of age 13, 14 at the Shropshire Wildlife Trust. I grew up in Shropshire and went to the offices in Shrewsbury and did quite a lot of volunteering work and just made really good contacts there and sort of then opportunities in all my school holidays. I took those opportunities and just really lucky to meet a guy actually who lived in my village, who was a conservation officer, John Tucker. And he became a good friend actually after that. And he used to ferry me into Shrewsbury in his car, so taking the bus. And yeah, he gave me lots of opportunities to help out with a lot of office tasks actually. Just even in those early days, I was helping input data for the Shropshire Bird Atlas, which maybe that's inspired some later work in my life. But it was just a really good to be able to do lots of different office jobs and a bit on the reserves as well when opportunities arose.
Fantastic. And it certainly didn't put you off, did it?
No. It's been a passion. Yeah, all my life, really, sort of birds and natural history and just being outdoors, frankly.
And getting to do that for a job as well. But before you started working at the BTO, you did a degree in environmental science?
That's right, yeah. I went down to Plymouth to do my degree in environmental science. It was Plymouth Poly at the time. And that's really the best thing I ever did. You know, growing up in a very landlocked county, being a keen birder, you know, to be honest, I hadn't seen very much before I went down to Plymouth. And they had an ornithological society and I just... quite a shy person actually at the time. I just sort of went along, signed up, and I went along to birders' night at the pub and stuff like that, and just sort of, you know, just kept I was very persistent, I think. Not surprisingly, sort of, you know, all the other people in the bird club down there were all males. But yeah, I was so keen, I just kept going, kept turning up. And eventually, obviously, you know, those people became fantastic friends of mine and, yeah, really encouraging throughout the whole time. But it was really life-changing just to be able to sort of be in a coastal locality, seeing a whole new bunch of birds and yeah, just the kindness of some of the people who had left Poly, actually, but were still living around Plymouth and had cars and took us Poly students out at the weekends to... around the South Hams and down to Cornwall for trips. Yeah, great, great friendships and kindness.
Sounds like you landed on your feet there. And it's nice to hear that as well, that because there's a lot of negative press, I guess, sometimes around the hobby, particularly men being sort of bullish and not too welcoming to newbies. So yeah, it's nice to hear that your experience is quite different to that.
Yeah, no, it was really good. And, you know, a lot of the species we spent a lot of time looking at, you know, especially sort of gulls on the estuary. You know, I was pretty clueless, to be honest. You know, living in Shropshire, didn't have much exposure to a lot of gulls. And yeah, they just taught me so much. And were really, really great. And as I say, most of them are sort of still best friends of mine.
Brilliant. I mean, if they were teaching you about gulls, they were probably just delighted that somebody else was interested.
Probably, yeah.
So After university, you started work for the BTO and you developed your interest in bird ID and migration and population trends further. And you've been really involved in local bird surveys and achieved over 30 years on your own sort of patch, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. So obviously working for BTO, and we organise a lot of surveys here. So my spare time, I do take part in as many surveys as possible, really. And yeah, I've been doing my breeding bird survey since year one in 1994 it started. And I actually did the year before and helped take part in the pilot survey on my square. So yeah, I'm lucky to have a couple of squares just in Thetford Forest, a short distance from home. And yeah, it's only, two visits in the breeding season. It's pretty easy, not too much time, but you just really get to know that patch, don't you? And you go there, and especially in the forest, you see the changes around the clear fell, the trees growing up, and you have birds come and go. And it's just really nice to spend all, over the years, see the changes in the squares. Becomes quite addictive, actually.
I can imagine. And your first local study involved, well, maybe not your typical British bird.
After joining BTO here, I obviously got to meet some of my colleagues, and we decided we would see if we could work on golden pheasants. So at the time, it's a bird of sort of Breckland, obviously reintroduced species a long time ago. There were still reasonable pockets of golden pheasants in the forest, and we worked on a small population out at Mayday Farm. I'm sure loads of birders and back in the early 90s would have gone to Mayday Farm sort of trying to peek down the rows of conifers, trying to get a glimpse of a golden pheasant as it walks through. But we undertook a study there to, basically we knew nothing about golden pheasants. Nobody really did in the UK. So we, after a lot of efforts, managed to catch a small number of birds and fit radio tags to them. So we used to spend a lot of time just tracking their movements. And finding some nests as well, that was quite a sort of new area of knowledge. And yeah, they don't go far. They're quite small territories. But finding the nests was really good. And it appears that the female, once she starts incubating, she doesn't leave the nest.
Right.
She just sits on it throughout the whole incubation period, and which was really interesting. But yeah, so they've really decline now across the forest. I guess there's very few introductions these days. I think there's a small number still going on.
Is that small number self-sustaining now,
I really don't think so anymore. No, just they've been lost from so many of the little fragmented bits of forest where they were in. I don't believe it's a self-sustaining population at all.
Right. So maybe just occasional releases to keep little pockets going, but
I suspect so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. And you're also a bird ringer. In fact, I witnessed you at Global Bird Fair on the ringing station with probably the best view I've ever had of a green woodpecker because somebody was holding it. But what is the most painful bird to have in the hand?
That's a good question, Kit. I mean, just things like great spotted woodpeckers, they can sort of like hammer at your fingers. I did sort of in the 90s quite a lot of bird ringing out on the island of Lesbos in Greece, and particularly in the autumn. That was a great project we ran for quite a few years, training local ringers in Greece to learn to ring, and obviously trying to understand more about autumn migration especially. But we caught a lot of redback shrikes.
Ooh.
And I'm sure any shrike, but my experience was with a redback shrike, whenever you put your hand into the net to try and extract it, their eyes are just on your fingers. And wherever your fingers go, the eyes follow and the beak follows and the feet. So they're particularly painful. They know how to clasp her really, really quite hard. But
I'm glad to hear that, because I love a redback shrike. And I imagine they would be like that, like tiny little, well, actually, I was going to say like little raptors, but actually raptors can sometimes be quite submissive when they're being handled as youngins, can't they? But I like that about the redback shrike.
They're
proper bitey and all pointy bits. That's good.
Absolutely.
Are there any birds that you haven't studied or worked with yet that you aspire to one day?
Oh, lots really. I mean, most of my work has just been around the Brecks here. But so, yeah, seabirds, done very little on seabirds. That's all, really fascinating group of birds. Obviously birds of prey, but to be honest, I'm happy sort of there's a lot on my plate just locally, still so much to understand around here. But
yes, it sounds like you are very busy as well. Okay, right then. So, as you probably know, Dawn, this podcast is based around the probably not too ridiculous premise that there is going to be a wildlife Armageddon, some sort of big world-ending event, which I've been doing this podcast since lockdown now, and it seems to be getting a more realistic a premise by the day. But you have to choose five bird species, your favorites, or the five that mean the most to you, and bundle them onto the metaphorical ark. These are the five bird species that you would save above all others if there was this environmental Armageddon. So let's talk about bird number one.
Bird number one.
Yeah, so bird number one's a yellowhammer for me. It's probably one of my earliest memories of a bird. As I said, I grew up in Shropshire, in, really rural Shropshire, right on the Welsh border, a place called Vennington. I lived next door, but one from my grandparents who were, sort of on a worked on a farm there. So just from a very young age, I can't remember, sort of 3, 4, certainly preschool, we used to go out on the farm with my nan, Nanny Bulmer, and take out some sandwiches to my granddad, who was in a tractor somewhere, and just to walk along the fields. And really vividly remember seeing and hearing yellowhammers on the hedges, curlews too. It was a time there was still quite a lot of curlews in Shropshire, really different now, but yellowhammer is sort of really sticks in my mind as a an image from a very young child.
I can imagine that as well, as a young child, a bright yellow bird on perched atop a hedgerow, shouting on about bread and cheese. I can imagine it's an easy one to learn at that age and to pick up on. And I guess your grandparents, being farmers, would have known all the local farm birds and pointed them out to you.
Yeah, exactly. I think I never saw a pair of binoculars around the house at all, but they just—you're right—they just knew the common birds of the countryside out there, and just would just talk about them. There was a couple of bird books in the house, so there was definitely some interest in birds. But I'd never a pair of binoculars, I guess. Just
And
used your eyes.
do you think that's where your interest started with your grandparents on the farm?
I think so, because it really was from a very young age that I was interested in birds, and my first notebook was as a 6-year-old, so I'm not sure I had any binoculars then, but I probably certainly had binoculars by the time I was sort of 7 or 8. So I think it's just been in me all of my life, really, and I just love being outside. It's where I'm happiest, even though I have a desk job now. It's just being outside is just what I enjoy most. But I'm sure those early experiences and also just growing up as a sort of young teenager, the freedom to go places. We moved to a village called Ponsbury when I was about 13 years old, and there was a nice big hill out the back, Earl's Hill, which had sort of pied flycatchers, redstarts, wood warblers at the time, and I just used to go out there walking sometimes with my mum. But just this freedom to go and not worry about any safety or anything like that. And I'd be, say, see you later and come back sort of 4 or 5 hours later, and just having enjoyed, walking around the hill.
Fantastic. And have you revisited your 6-year-old, notebook? Because my records from when I was a kid are very sketchy. A wall creeper behind the bins at school, golden eagle off the coast, osprey in the local park. I suspect that you would have been a bit more accurate than I was.
Yeah, I don't think there's too many dodgy records in there like that, but it was pretty sparse. So I, one there's definitely like turnstones at Colwyn Bay, because we used to go to the coast a lot for holidays and stuff. So it was just, and I remember going to see the little terns at Point of Ayre when I was very young. So it was just very sporadic note taking at that age. But I still have it, and it's an aspiration of mine when I do get some free time to put all my old notebooks into BirdTrack. That's really what I want to do, so I can look back. But I need a few more hours in the day to do that at the moment.
I'm not sure where you're going to find them, Dawn. I love a yellowhammer, even though they don't like cheese. But my favourite thing about a yellowhammer is that they were once called the scribble bird or the scribble lark because of the little fine red scribbly markings on the eggs. And that in days gone by, it was believed that those little scribbly red markings were a message from Satan. So they used to be seen as a bird of the devil. Which, yeah, I just love that. It was believed that, or some people believed that the Yellowhammer contained a drop of the devil's blood in its tongue.
Oh, wow. That's a new one on me, Kit. That's great.
Yeah, isn't it cool? But yeah, I suspect that the devil stopped putting messages on Yellowhammer's eggs as they started to decline, and that was not really very fruitful for Satan. It's maybe why he switched to putting messages on records backwards in the 70s, as probably at the same time as the Yellowhammer declined. I don't know. It's just a theory. I might work that up for British Birds. Right, Yellowhammer. Let's move on from this tomfoolery to bird number two.
Bird number two.
So yeah, bird number two's a Mediterranean gull, and I suppose in my journey from a young person going to down to Plymouth, Med gull is a bird that really sticks out in my mind because we spent a lot of time, probably too much time, at the sailing club on the Plym estuary, scanning the estuary for gulls. And at that time, the Plym was really an amazing place for gulls because just behind was Chelsea Meadows, really active rubbish tip. And the gulls would pile off the tip onto the estuary and out in Plymouth, Plymouth Harbour, Plymouth Hoe. There were still outfalls going, which is not great, but it was a really good place for gulls. So we spent a lot of time on the estuary by the sailing club, just with our telescopes scanning. And one of the thrills was like picking out a med gull amongst all the black-headed gulls. I think it was a bit of a sort of birder's bird, and I just always love their plumages. Just have beautiful fresh juveniles and first winters, second winters, a lovely, spring this time of year. Actually, you might get an adult with a jet black head and orange bill and legs, stunning white primaries. Just, I think in every plumage they look really amazing. And I think it was just that thrill of picking them out, and that's always stuck with me actually. And I'm quite into gulls, generally throughout my life now. And around here in the Brecks, actually, med gulls are really quite scarce. So I've managed to find sort of one on my patch this year, but it's despite having a lot of gulls around here, Mediterranean gulls are pretty scarce birds. I
Really?
mean, up on the coast, in the breeding season, they're really starting to take off as breeding birds, which is fantastic to see. And we have these amazing late summer gatherings at places like Breydon Water with huge number, hundreds and hundreds now. But that's absolutely one of my favourite birds.
They are a beautiful, stunning bird. And yeah, they actually do have a black head, unlike the black-headed gull, which has got obviously more of a sort of chocolatey brownie head, hasn't it? And the white wing tips and everything like that. But they are doing really well. I think I read that the first UK pair that nested was back in 1968, but prior to that, I mean, certainly prior to 1940, they were very rare and only a few dozen records back then. But now we've got over 600 breeding pairs, I believe, and nearly 2,000 wintering birds every year.
Yeah, I think actually the number of pairs is much greater than that. I think it's
Is
about
it?
1,600 pairs.
Oh,
I'll
wow.
have to
Okay.
check on that. But they've been doing incredibly well. Obviously some sites have very large numbers, such as down in Hampshire,
Yeah.
sort of a lot of birds in one place, but they're starting to spread out a little bit. So we have a few sort of breeding birds here in Norfolk, but inland locations like they've bred in Shropshire now, for example, which is such a so hard to imagine that when you sort of grew up there a long time ago. But yeah, and they're just generally spreading north slowly as well. So
Yeah.
yeah, one of in fact of all the seabirds, it's one of the seabirds that is actually a very positive story at the moment. As you say, a lot of our seabirds are really suffering for a wide range of reasons.
And why does this one seem to be bucking the trend, do you think?
I guess perhaps partly climate, but just a lot of protected sites as well. Some of the sites are on are sort of quite well protected sites. They're just expanding their range generally in parts of Europe, and probably getting more coming through in the autumn, winter, and staying to breed.
I was out with our mutual friend Mark Eaton in January on the Northumberland bird race. Mark found all the birds. I plucked Jay at the very end of the day, but yeah, I think the rest of the team got everything else. But yeah, Mark, we went to one site at Newbiggin just to scan for med gulls, and big flocks of birds. They're quite distant, and he's just
Picking
pointing
them
them
out.
out to me. And once I'm on it, I can go, oh yeah, I can see it, but 100 birds in the air and, picking out the winter med gull in that at a distance. Yeah, it's quite impressive. But yeah, he'll be like you. He'll have watched a lot of Medgulls, far more than I have over the years.
Yeah, it's just quite addictive, I think, isn't it? Scanning through a flock. Well, it is for me anyway. You always want to have one more scan just in case anything's dropped in since like 3 minutes ago when you last looked.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, done how many recordings now? This must be mid-30s in terms of the episodes I've done for the podcast, and I think it's only the second time we've had a go. So yeah, nice to book the trend. So let's move on and we'll talk about
Bird number three.
And my third bird is the Hooper Swan. And this is a bird that really, over about the last 10 years, I've really got to know quite a lot more. So, here in Norfolk in the Fens, we're really lucky to have very large numbers wintering sort of on the sort of ooze washes, particularly out at Welney. So, I've been spending quite a bit of time in the winter going out there, particularly looking in the fields to look for colourings. Again, I suppose it's linked to my sort of ringing interest because a lot of effort's put into sort of colour ringing Hooper swans in Iceland, particularly, and also obviously look out for Bewick swans as well. But they winter, I think, is around 15,000 out in the Fens, sort of Cambridgeshire, Norfolk Fens at the moment. So there's plenty of birds to look through, and it's just, it's quite a stark landscape, the Fens in the winter, quite a lot of dark, black, peaty soils. Very few people, bumpy roads, and it's just, I quite like going out there. It's a bit of an old place at times, but just seeing all the, you spot in the distance a big white flock, the swans, let's go and have a look. And going down to, hopefully they're quite close so you can have a good look for colour rings and also sort of get an idea of how good the breeding season's been because they travel in their family parties. So you normally have the two adults plus young, sometimes, sort of two young, three young, occasionally five young. So you can count all of that actually and record it all part of some of our projects looking at age assessments. So you can start to look at the productivity of Hooper swan from year to year by sort of making those, pretty simple calculations, actually.
I think that's the thing, isn't it, with ringing birds as well, especially quite long-lived birds, that seeing them year on year and following their story and their history.
Yeah, you get to know some individuals. You sort of see a ring. Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've had that one before. And there's a nice story about the yellow ring TAA, which I saw a couple of years ago, and obviously submitted the record, and it was ringed in Iceland in 2020, and it came back, and I've seen it quite a few times now. And I remember chatting to a sort of friend of mine, James McCallum, and he had been lucky enough to go to Iceland in the breeding season. I mentioned this TAA, and well, he'd seen TAA on the breeding grounds in Iceland and was like really amazed that we'd seen it in the fields. So I said, well, next time we see it, we'll let you know. And sure enough, next winter it returned. So I let him know. And he came out to the Fens eventually. And they're quite faithful to the fields for, whilst it's good feeding days, weeks. So James came out, and I think second time he managed to connect and was really thrilled just to make that connection between seeing the bird on the breeding grounds and then in a field out on Southerley Fen. Was pretty good, and actually just spotted TAA last Thursday.
Oh, lovely.
Took the day off work with my daughter to go and have a look at some, do some colouring reading, and then I hadn't seen it all winter despite quite a lot of effort, and there it was, just
Made
In a
it after all.
field. It's brilliant.
Excellent. That's great, isn't it? Because that takes birding to a whole different level, isn't it? When you're looking at an individual that you've seen before and have a connection with, and especially if you've seen it on its breeding ground and its wintering ground, that's
Yeah, that's pretty good.
pretty special.
Yeah, I think, it's just as bird watchers, we can just help build up that sort of life history of a bird by sort of looking at the colourings and, providing the birds are close enough, it's pretty straightforward to read. Well, usually to read the ring, and sometimes it isn't. Just a Bewick swan last week had a neck collar on, and I managed to track it down. Actually, it was just ringed in Germany in December last year, and that was out in the Fens as well. So, it's really nice just to be able to build up that life history over years, and maybe I'll see that bird again next winter.
Yeah, fantastic. A lot of birds get seen as bad omen birds, don't they? Ravens and any blackbird really. But possibly because they're white, swans, particularly the birds that come in the winter, were seen as a good omen. I read in Birds Britannica again, it said that somebody had commented that having large and heavy birds near the house made winter more interesting and bearable. And that some people, I guess because they're big and white, obviously attached some sort of angelic type presence to them and thought that they got some sort of protection. And something I didn't realize until I'd read this was that the term swan song comes because of the very long trachea, and a dying bird makes a prolonged wailing flute-like sound as they gasp their last breath, and that's where swan song comes from, which I hadn't realized before.
Yeah, that's interesting, Kit, to hear that. Yeah, I mean, I love hearing the Hooper swans as well. It's just such a really great call, isn't it? And I don't really encounter them much around the Brecks, away from out in the fens. You know, they obviously fly over to and from Iceland and stuff. But yes, it's great when you hear a migrating swan, isn't it? And you think, oh gosh, yeah, what's that? Hooper or Bewick's.
And they do make a very distinctive sound, which they're obviously named after. But as a kid, I don't know whether it was because I read a lot of comics, Whizzer and Chips, and a WH was always a whoop, you know. So I pronounced it wrong until my mid-teens, I'm sure, calling them whooper swans. I still pronounce hoopoe wrong, but sue me. But yeah, it's one of the perils of being self-taught, I think. But yeah, lovely birds. Do you get many Bewicks? Because we don't get many in Northumberland.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a well-known story around the Bewick swans that they used to come here in pretty large numbers. In fact, probably out in the fens, it would have been primarily Bewicks, a long time ago. And obviously, Hoopers are actually doing incredibly well population-wise in Iceland now. But Bewicks, they tend to be they're short-stopping, so our milder winters means there are fewer coming to our shores in Britain and Ireland than there used to be. So places like Slimbridge and fens just don't get as many. So I saw 129 last week in a field, which was my highest number this week, and I think there's been around 300 or 400 out in the fens this year. And yeah, this winter had been really low numbers until we had that little cold spell sort of early in February, and I think it was a bit, or late January, a bit of arrival at that point.
The birds I've seen over the last few years have just been in, like, ones or twos, you know.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
yeah, that's
I'd say it's not, it's mainly due to short stopping, so still sort of decent numbers in sort of the Netherlands and Germany, for example.
yeah, interesting. Okay, let's move on to
Bird number four.
Yep, so bird number four's and the woodlark. A bird I've really got to love actually just in more recent times, particularly since COVID, I think, when we were sort of more forced to do much more local bird watching. And I started going to what is my patch now, East Wrentham Heath. I've been there lots of times, so since the 90s when I sort of started living around here, but never really went there much. But now I've got quite addicted to the place and go several times a week. And I think one of the really special birds there is woodlark. So it's just a it's sort of heathland, but a bit of Clearfell area, which holds it's got two singing males on at the minute. And just yeah, really, I never really felt much attachment to like bird song particular. I obviously always enjoyed bird song, but never thought, oh gosh, I love that bird song. But actually, there is something about woodlark, especially on these cold, frosty mornings. You go out and there's not much else singing at this time of year. Maybe the odd chaffinch just starting up, but the woodlark's singing. It's there already, defending its territory, and it just you can hear it quite a long distance as well. And it's all its lovely fluty notes. It actually just really makes me very happy to hear it, and it's a good start to the day.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it's a bird that I'm not very familiar with at all, you know, being in Northumberland. They don't really come this far north. But yeah, I understand that a lot of people love the song of the woodlark, and I think some people revere it almost to nightingale levels of song smithery. But yeah, not a call that I'm hugely familiar with, because don't
You
just
just don't
don't
get them.
yeah
No.
they don't travel up here. In
No.
fact, I was reading that the Robbie Burns poem Addressed to the Woodlark, which is actually a poem about loss and grief, which kind of goes a little bit against the fact that the woodlark song isn't melancholy sounding, is it? It is quite uplifting.
It's quite joyful, yeah.
Yeah, and Robbie Burns never travelled south of Carlisle, so there's a bit of controversy as to whether he was actually listening to a woodlark or not. Who knows? In olden days, some people used to call woodlarks tree pipits, you know, interchangeably, the word, not the species, but the tree pipit. So whether he was just getting mixed up and I was actually listening to a tree pivot.
Yeah,
People
interesting.
don't really know, or maybe they were in Scotland and they've just shrunk back. But they're doing quite well, I understand.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well around here. Obviously, really dependent on good habitat like the clearfell areas, and that can change a lot in the forest. As you know, obviously, say here in Thetford Forest, it's a managed forest. You know, it's a commercial forest, so the patches change. Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating species as well because yeah, the first one to return this year was the 29th of January. So they've actually, I think they probably leave the site in the winter, or they're just incredibly hard to detect. And so I last recorded Woodlark at East Rethym in mid-October. And despite going like every couple of days, just didn't get another one until this beautiful frosty morning on the 29th of January this year. And I heard one, it was pretty amazing. But yeah, I'm not quite sure where they go. I mean, it's possibly not very far, maybe just to sort of surrounding farmland, and we just don't find them in the winter. So there's a bit of a mystery where they go. But they come back quite early and start, yeah, very early nester actually. So yeah, right now is almost sort of peak time for going out to listen to them.
It's amazing that, isn't it? A species that is fairly well known in certain areas, it's still a bit of a mystery as to where they go to in those 3 or 4 winter months.
Yeah, I think sort of even going back 10 years, 15 years, there's probably more records from bait ringing recoveries of birds moving to the southwest in winter. And I think we're just not seeing that as much. Maybe we're not ringing as many woodlarks as we used to get the information, but it definitely seems to be more of a feeling that they're staying more local than perhaps they used to. And yeah, just not finding them. Need to go and walk some more farmland in winter.
Yeah, like I say, that I'm jealous because we just don't get them up here, and there's none on the island of Ireland either. You know, like a few notable birds that are missing from Ireland. But yeah, a lovely bird, and I will add the call and the song onto this afterwards so that everybody can get a little fix.
Yeah, brilliant.
Right then, let's talk about your fifth and final choice.
Bird number five.
Yep, so bird five's a Manx shearwater. Yeah, as a bird, I really enjoy sea watching. Don't get to do very much of it, but yeah, normally try to manage a holiday down in Cornwall in the autumn, especially during half terms over sort of many years. And you know, nice sea watch, blowy conditions at Pendeen and Manx shearwaters whizzing past, lovely light, and you see the black and white alternating as they fly past it. You know, it's always, yeah, brilliant to see birds at sea. I think sea watching is a great hobby and wish I could do it more often, but that's, you know, just always thinking about, wonder where that bird breds and where's it going to winter. Is it going to go to sort of Brazil, Argentina? It's got a long way to go yet. But also just sort of, yeah, more recent experience of going to Bardsey Island actually with my daughter, she had to do her work experience for her GCSE time at high school, and she said she fancied going to Bardsey Island, and I said, well, I better come with you then. And well, also for her age, she needed looking after, and it was just the most amazing experience for both of us actually. And she's quite into birds as well, but just being on an island where there's like, I think it's something like 26,000 occupied burrows. You know, Manx shearwaters are everywhere. You know, in the daytime, there's not a sign of them. Obviously, they're all in the burrows, in the stone walls, in the hillside. Just like incredible density of Manx shearwaters. But come night, it's just like amazing experience just going out, especially in the summertime, sort of July, August time, whizzing around your head, calling, and yeah, just really, yeah, really great opportunity, and very lucky also to be able to get to do some of the monitoring work on Bardsey.
Fantastic. I mean, they are. We've talked about storm petrels, Leatherrickian, the storm petrel, and they have similar habits
Oh, yeah.
and things. But they are fantastic birds, and it's that sort of otherworldly element to them. You know, living in the burrows and coming in at night, and the crazy sounds that they make. But you've had experience of having to stick your hands into the burrows, haven't you?
Yeah, so it was really lucky. I'm obviously on Bardsey, but there's Bardsey Bird Observatory, and they've done lots of fantastic monitoring over the years and know so much about the Manx shearwaters now. And you know, they annually monitor some plots, a part of our seabird monitoring programme. So yeah, within that they count the occupied burrows throughout the season. There's a whole network of burrows in the stone walls and hillsides. Some, you know, you can put your hand in and sort of reach a bird. Others, the burrow just goes way back and you've not got a chance. So yeah, especially later in the season when there's juveniles around, you don't know if you're going to get a little fluffy bundle to pull out or if you're going to get a sharp beak of a adult that's facing you and wanting to bite your hand. But it's fantastic work to be able to bring the birds out. Obviously there's lots of birds already have rings because they've been doing this for so many years. They get lots of retrap and life history data, but work around weighing the chicks, eventually ringing the chick, looking at their sort of growth rates and breeding success of the bird. So it's a real privilege to be able to get really up close and see the birds in the daytime like that.
I can imagine. It sounds fantastic. And I mean, these are long-lived birds, like a lot of seabirds, aren't they? I mean, I think you'll know better than me, but I think they can. Is the longest lived Manx shearwater over 50 years old?
Absolutely something like that. So I think when we were on Bardsey, we caught a retrap, and I remember Steve Stansfield, warden, saying, "Oh, that's pretty old." And I think he looked up; it was 1985. It's just quite amazing, isn't it? To think.
It's crazy. It is when you consider the distances that these birds travel as well, just in a day while they're out fishing, they can.
I think, that's some of the incredible work. There's some PhD students been working on Bardsey, and they've been putting tags on the birds and then retrieving the tags to look at their foraging journeys. And it's quite incredible that I think some of the birds go almost up to Iceland, just off the west coast of Iceland, on foraging trips. And certainly up to places like Rum, on a very regular basis, off Ireland, and sometimes just obviously in the Irish Sea. But some incredibly long foraging trips. You just wouldn't have dreamt they were doing that without the use of technology to tell us this kind of information.
It's just crazy to think they'll be traveling 1,000 kilometers, 2,000, in a day or two, because I think one parent stays with the young at the nest site for the first couple of months, is that right? And then the other one, they take turns eating, the other one will go off and do the foraging and come back and feed them.
Really amazing birds. And another memory of Bardsey that really sticks to mind is obviously they have some outdoor toilets at the bird observatory, and like if you need the loo in the night, you have to sort of trek down, and so you can just be crossing the little yard at the back and there can be Manx shearwater just scurrying around looking for its burrow, which is only probably just on the hillside behind. But really special memories of those kinds of encounters.
Imagine how bad you'd feel stepping on a 50-year-old Manx shearwater just nipping to the loo. I've never been anywhere like this, but I've seen it on the TV shows and things, and it just looks fantastic. And the noises they make, I mean, again, a bit like a storm petrel, they make quite an unusual sound, don't they?
That's right, it's quite an eerie sound, isn't it? And there's been lots of stories about people living on these places and hearing the call and wondering what on earth it is. But it's such a privilege, isn't it, to be able to like go to bed and hear Manx shearwaters flying around. You can do this on a number of places, but really made quite a big imprint in my mind in recent years. Just a couple of years ago I did that, and it's really special times.
That sounds amazing. I'll have to try and do that sometime. And for listeners who don't know, people might be interested in this, I certainly was, that the Latin name for a Manx shearwater is puffinus, which obviously is quite confusing because they're not puffins, but apparently a puffin or a puffling in 17th century was any fat little pot-bellied bird, and it came to be used as a trade name for any rotund seabird of economic value was a puffin or a puffling. But then shearwater, obviously a much more appropriate name, eventually took over, and puffin became the daft looking bird that we know and love today. So they got stuck with puffin, and Manx shearwater got a much cooler name, which does beautifully describe what they do when they're out at sea, being so majestic, because we all know that they're rubbish on land. And in fact, that's why they nest in burrows and come in at night, is because they're rubbish on land. And it's a protection strategy, isn't it, to come in dark. And
it's such a contrast, isn't it, between that elegance of seeing them flying at sea on migration, passing headlands, to see them sort of scrabbling around trying to find their burrows. And it's got quite sharp little nails on their feet, just obviously helps them create the burrow in the first place, but just helps them move forward. So really, really fascinating species.
Definitely. And is it true, or is it still true, should I say, that 90% of the world's birds breed around the British Isles?
Yeah, that sounds about right, Kit. I haven't got the stats to hand, but very important. Britain and Ireland, yeah, hugely important for Manx shearwater and other seabirds as well. But
Amazing, but no longer on the Isle of Man, I believe. Even though they're named Manx
Manx
Shearwater, where
shearwater.
they, yeah, they're not there anymore. A Viking war party in the year 1014 was anchored off the Isle of Man, heard the eerie nocturnal screams and the chuckles and the crazy noises they make, and imagined hostile night ravens of ill omen. And this story then got turned into a report that claimed that they had attacked the Viking fleet and killed a number of the Vikings as well. So, yeah, don't mess with the Manx Shearwater. They can
No, I
kill
think there's probably
Vikings.
loads of stories about Manx shearwaters on islands.
So, Dawn, those are the five birds that mean the most to you. But now you must choose one bird to rule them all, or really just the one bird that will be your companion or spirit guide as you roam the desolate wasteland after this environmental apocalypse that's heading our way. So, which of those five is your ultimate favourite?
Well, it's very easy actually, because it's long been my favourite, which is a Mediterranean gull. Perhaps it's your first gull as a first choice, I don't know, but
It might be, actually. I'll have to see. It was herring gull we talked about last time and whether that
got the
did make the
first.
final cut. Fantastic. So, thanks so much for coming on today, Dawn. I was going to ask you if people have been listening today and did want to get involved in local bird surveys, how would they go about that?
Oh, cool. Yeah, there's lots of opportunities. Certainly BTO runs lots of surveys, so just having a check on our website. We've got a quite busy summer ahead, actually, as well as our sort of usual breeding bird surveys and seabird monitoring program and things like that. We've got a survey running this year called the Heathland Bird Survey, and we're doing UK-wide surveys of woodlark, Dartford warbler and nightjar. So we're looking for a lot of volunteers across the UK. Obviously, some those species have quite limited ranges and different ranges, so not everybody will be able to take part. But yeah, there are literally thousands of squares to be covered this spring. So you can have a look at the BTO website and take on a square. And yeah, opportunities for early mornings and late nights, depending if you're a night owl or an early bird.
Great stuff. I noticed that there's some nightjar squares near me. So,
That's right. Yes, nightjar's going to be fascinating because we think they're doing. We know there's a population, increasing population in Scotland now. So you're probably up near you as well, and there's probably some new sites to be discovered. We've put a few sites up in Northern Ireland. They're not known to breed there, but there's suitable habitat. So we can see if we can get some people out checking.
yeah,
If you don't
fantastic.
look, you don't find, do you?
Exactly. And so apart from that, what else have you got lined up in the forthcoming year?
Well, work-wise, we're really busy prepping for the next Bird Atlas.
Oh,
So I
yes.
was heavily involved in the last one back in 2007 to 11 as coordinator, and we're looking to start the next one in November 2027. It seems like ages away, but I know it's going to go really quickly. So we've got a lot of preparation work to do with that around sort of methods and engagement and just fundraising, of course. So that's on my work agenda. And yeah, for me, just I'll keep busy at the weekends with my sort of local birding and some survey work, and try and take part in as many local surveys as possible.
Great. Oh, well, thanks so much again, Dawn, for coming on. It's been brilliant talking to you, and I hope your local surveys are fruitful this year.
Great, thanks, Kip.
Take care.